past year saw the full expose of an organization guilty for decades of horrific activities, including assassination plots against world leaders, the use of torture and mind-altering drugs, spying on American citizens, selling and trading arms, and participating in what many would consider terrorist activities. No, I'm not talking about Al-Qaeda, but the CIA, our own Central Intelligence Agency. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines of Legacy of Ashes, the history of the CIA. This winner of the 2007 National Book Award for Nonfiction was written by my guest today, Tim Weiner. Tim is a New York Times journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner twice for his investigative work on secret national security programs. His firsthand coverage of covert operations and national intelligence for, well, over 20 years has provided the background to produce and assess a critical history of the CIA. Legacy of Ashes is based on materials gleaned from actual on-the-record interviews and documents, including previously classified documents. No anonymous sources here, real people and real facts. I've been looking forward to talking with Tim Weiner. Thank you so much for allowing us to go between the lines with you today, Tim.
Pleasure, Valerie. Thanks for inviting me on.
Many Americans have a glamorized concept or idea of the CIA, thoughts of James Bond and high-tech gadgets and fast cars and fast women. Was the history of the CIA ever anything like that?
You know, it really wasn't. We get our images, our thoughts about what CIA is, mostly from the movies. People think it's Mission Impossible. Well, some people think it's Get Smart. You think of, the guy in a trench coat who parachutes into a foreign capital in the morning, overthrows the government before dinner, goes back to the hotel for a dry martini and some hot lovemaking, and he's gone at dawn. It's not like that, and it never was.
What was it supposed to be originally? Why? What was the whole concept? Because I think it came about after World War II, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. When World War II ended, the United States found itself bestriding the world like a colossus. We were the most powerful nation on earth. The Soviets had lost 27 million dead. Europe was in rubble. Much of Asia was in rubble. And the British Empire, which had been the most powerful force on earth politically for a century, was bankrupt. And the Brits said essentially, over to you. You're going to defend Western civilization and Christendom now. Our World War II ally, the Soviet Union, had driven westward all the way to Berlin, and the Iron Curtain descended throughout Central Europe. We hadn't the foggiest idea what went on behind the Iron Curtain, and we saw the Soviet Union as a threat to the West, to Christendom, to American values. We had never had a permanent peacetime civilian intelligence service in this country. Secrecy, deception, those weren't American traditions. But Harry Truman, although he had disbanded the wartime intelligence service, the OSS. Harry Truman decided that we needed a spy service to figure out what was going on in the world. And so the CIA was born in 1947, a little more than 60 years ago.
Now, the OSS was originally just for military intelligence, right?
Well, it was a wartime civilian service, and they did a number of things behind the lines in occupied France and in occupied portions of Western Europe during the war, as well as in Asia. This included parachuting behind enemy lines, for example, in occupied France, to hook up with partisan resistance forces to sabotage German positions. And the CIA, from its inception, decided that it could try to operate behind the Iron Curtain and after 1950 behind the Bamboo Curtain, since China went communist,
right,
to operate behind the Iron Curtain the way the OSS had operated behind enemy lines in World War II, and it didn't work.
Why? Why not?
These were police states. We were taking thousands of recruited foreign agents, Russians, Eastern Europeans, Koreans, Chinese, and training them up for a few months, strapping parachutes on their back, and throwing them out like so much human confetti into the darkness to try and spy on our enemies. And these operations were disastrous. They didn't work. We lost thousands of recruited foreign agents that way in the early years of the CIA into the 1950s.
Why did we lose so many people? Were we just not prepared and competent? What was it?
We didn't know what we were doing. This was something new under the sun, trying to run a secret intelligence service in an open American democracy. The few lessons we'd learned from the British during World War II didn't apply very well when it came to trying to undermine, sabotage, spy on the Soviets, Communist China, North Korea, and the satellite states of behind the Iron Curtain, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania.
What precedent was it that called the CIA a legacy of ashes, and why?
Dwight Eisenhower, in the last months of his presidency in 1960, began to despair over the whole idea of central intelligence. It was the duty of the director of central intelligence not just to run the CIA, but also to coordinate all American intelligence, military and civilian, and to weave it together for the president. The problem is it's always been like an orchestra where every instrument's got a different score, and the conductor has had a hell of a hard time trying to harmonize the players. And Dwight Eisenhower, in a series of meetings of the National Security Council in those last months of his presidency, in the same weeks that you'll remember he gave a farewell address warning us about the disastrous rise of misplaced power in the military-industrial
complex.
He began to despair of a unified American intelligence under the CIA and within the CIA. And he said to Alan Dulles, who was the director of Central Intelligence, "You know, I've been after you for 8 years to get this together, and I have suffered an eight-year defeat." General Eisenhower didn't like defeat. And he lamented aloud, "I am going to hand on to my successor a legacy of ashes." And 4 months later came the Bay of Pigs.
Whoa.
Ike was right.
I'm amazed at why we couldn't have been more efficient.
We were new at this, Valerie. The Russians had been at this for 300 years in the time of the Cold War, going back to Peter the Great. The British had been at it for 500 years, going back to Queen Elizabeth I. The Chinese have been at it for 2,600 years, going back to Sun Tzu in The Art of War.
Right.
And, you know, Sun Tzu said in The Art of War, that great classic written 6 centuries before Christ, "Know your enemy." That's the key. Well, we didn't know our enemy. We didn't know what was going on in the Soviet Union. We didn't know what was going on in the Islamic world. We didn't know what was going on in the developing third world, in Africa and in Asia. And it's a job of espionage to try and find out.
We didn't know what was going on. I suspect a lot of it had to do with the fact that many of our agents didn't even speak the language of the country that they were spying on.
You know, in the early years of the CIA, there were a goodly number of people who had been born in Budapest or Moscow, places that were now behind the Iron Curtain, and they did know the language and the history and the culture of the places that we were trying to spy on. As time went by, there were fewer and fewer. The CIA began to resemble a kind of a white shirt Virginia country club kind of a place. And it's very hard to spy on, let's say, Afghanistan, or let's say China, or let's say Iraq, if you look like you just got off the bus from Wichita, Kansas, you know. This is a continuing problem.
Even today?
It faces us today. There are, you know, at the end of 2006, I don't know what the more recent numbers are, there were 6 Americans in the Green Zone in Baghdad. among the thousands and thousands and thousands of American military and diplomatic and intelligence people there who could speak Arabic. Six. This is a problem. It's
only
a serious
six,
problem.
Only, you're saying only six could speak Arabic?
That's right.
Wow.
And we wind up as a consequence all over the world, and this has been a problem for decades, buying our intelligence from so-called friendly foreign intelligence services. And Valerie, there aren't any friendly foreign intelligence service. Nations don't have friends. They have interests.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Let's talk about a few of the directors of the CIA. Who were the directors that you felt were most critical to its evolution, whether it was negatively or positively?
Well, in the early years, the CIA was very much a creature of Allen Dulles, who served as director of Central Intelligence under Presidents Eisenhower and briefly under President Kennedy until the Bay of Pigs in 1961. Allen Dulles's brother was the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles.
Right.
The two were a very potent pair. There has never been a brother act like that in modern American history. And these two guys, John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles, would sit around the pool at their sister Eleanor's house on Sunday afternoons and kind of figure out the foreign policy of the United States between themselves over a cocktail. Mm. The only times in its history that the CIA has really slipped its leash in a serious way were during those years. They didn't always tell the president what they were up to.
Well, not only that, but from what I gather in the book, they weren't beyond lying to the president even.
There was some of that. The reality was that the CIA in the 50s had a terrific reputation and a terrible record. Mm. And it was a brand new agency, and in order to preserve itself, it had to project an image of success, a shining image of success, even when the record was far, far worse. Dulles ran the ship aground at the Bay of Pigs, and he was fired. And President Kennedy, 4 months into his presidency, made a very dangerous decision. He gave some of the most difficult and dangerous operations of the CIA to his brother, the 35-year-old Attorney General of the United States, Robert F. Kennedy. That was a mistake. This is where you start seeing the things that really stain the honor of the United States in this era, the assassination plots against Fidel Castro being the prime example. There was kind of a murderous mood that swept the government after the Bay of Pigs. And the Kennedys played foreign policy the way they played backroom politics, bare knuckles. You see a lot of dirty pool being played in this era. Really, the most important person, though, in the Cold War history of the CIA was Richard Helms. Helms ran the agency for 7 years, from 66 to the end of 72, under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. Helms had served in the OSS. He had devoted his life to intelligence. He was deeply committed to making an American espionage service work. And one of the high points in the history of the CIA is that after President Johnson sent 500,000 American combat troops to Vietnam, this is a little over 40 years ago now, Richard Helms and the CIA tried to tell President Johnson that the war in Vietnam was a political war and that it would not be won by military means alone, no matter how many bombs, no matter how many men we threw in there. Lyndon Johnson didn't want to hear that. But Helms gave it to him with the bark off. He gave it to him straight. And that is one of the things I think the CIA can be proud of, is trying to get Vietnam right. Well, in the end, if presidents don't want to hear what the CIA is saying, it's not going to work. As Helms said later in life, if we are not believed, we have no purpose.
What was the general relationship between the president and the CIA, any president, the sitting president?
Richard Helms said later in his life that only one president has ever understood the first thing about the secret operations of the CIA. Guess who that might
Bush.
Be? Bush the Elder. That's right.
Yeah,
because,
H.W.
Because George Bush the Elder ran the CIA for 11 months back in 1976 under President Ford. And not only did he understand it better than any other president, he really loved it. He loved the place. But the cruel fact is that the relationship between the president and the CIA has often been tormented, and never more so than under Richard Nixon. Mm. Nixon hated and feared and detested and mistrusted the CIA. You know, when he and Henry Kissinger went to deal with the Russians or the Chinese or the North Vietnamese, they didn't tell the CIA what they were doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kissinger was basically being the CIA, wasn't he?
Well, he was being Super K, you know, flying all over the world in secret.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very nearly the death of the American Intelligence Service, to have a president who misused and abused it like this. And the ultimate misuse was trying to use the CIA, Richard Nixon did, to cover up the Watergate break-in. And the first article of impeachment against him before he resigned in disgrace in 1974 was using the CIA to obstruct justice. That was a low point.
Wow. Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going Between the Lines with Pulitzer Prize-winning author, New York Times journalist Tim Weiner. He's written a book, Legacy of Ashes, that covers the CIA operations, well, the history of it since its inception. What about the relationship with the Pentagon, the CIA and the Pentagon?
Tormented. The fact is that today, the CIA is only one of 16 American intelligence agencies, and it is no longer first among equals. It was demoted 3 years ago as a direct consequence of the Iraq weapons of mass destruction fiasco. That's correct.
Wow.
And a new super chief of American intelligence was created. He's called the Director of National Intelligence. The CIA is now just one among 16. It's not the big kid on the block anymore. The Secretary of Defense is the 800-pound gorilla in this particular zoo. He controls somewhere around 80-85% of the secret American intelligence budget, which is now well north of $50 billion a year.
Well, that's what I want to – my next question was going to be the budget. Where in the world are they getting the money from to fund these efforts, which go into the millions and over the years has added up to billions of dollars? Where is that money coming from?
Because the United States Congress, Valerie, but in a very secret way, okay? Now, our Constitution says, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7, that you're not supposed to have a secret budget in this country, that Congress is supposed to publish a full statement, a full account of the money it gets from the taxpayers, okay? That's the deal. We give them our money in taxes. They give us information back. That's the constitutional machine, okay? An exception was made back in 1949 for the CIA and for secret intelligence spending. That money is buried in false line items in the Pentagon's budget. That's the only place big enough to hide it.
Right.
Okay? The military budget of the United States, the Pentagon's budget, not counting the costs of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, is now more than $500 billion with a B dollars a year. The secret intelligence budget is about one-tenth of that, about $50 billion with a B dollars a year, and it is hidden in various dummy accounts, under code names, under false line items, inside the Pentagon's budget. It's known as the black budget, as in secret, covert, hidden, no light shines on it. And Congress, in its wisdom, has created this.
So when did the domestic spying start? Because technically the CIA is supposed to be about foreign countries and individuals.
It was John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Mm. In 1962. And the purpose was to stop leaks from the Pentagon to the press. It didn't start with Richard Nixon. It started with John Fitzgerald Kennedy. It continued under President Johnson, and it crested under President Nixon. The use of the CIA to spy on Americans during the Cold War is one of the least pleasant chapters in our history of the CIA. It was Harry Truman's greatest fear when he set up the CIA that something like this would happen. He was worried about, his words, an American Gestapo starting up inside our government. Well, of course, Nixon got caught doing this, but it's only been in the last couple of years that Kennedy's own White House tapes have revealed that he too used the CIA to spy on Americans, and so did President Johnson. Now, what's going on today? We will know better in 30 years when the documents of this White House are declassified, if indeed they ever are. But it's quite clear that after 9/11, the President of the United States decided to use certainly the National Security Agency, which conducts electronic eavesdropping, and also the CIA, to spy within the borders of the United States. We have to be very careful, very alert about this, because we do not want foreign intelligence services to be used as cops in this country. That is not what America is about.
And is that, from what I gather, too, there's been a redefinition of the CIA, and now this administration, you feel, is using it more as a kind of a paramilitary type of
organization? There's no question that after 9/11, the President of the United States turned to the CIA and said, the gloves are off. I want you to round up every potential terrorist suspect on this planet and do what you have to do to prevent another attack on the United States. The CIA takes orders from the President of the United States. It was the President who said, set up the secret prisons. It was the President who authorized the CIA to use techniques tantamount to torture to elicit information from terrorist suspects. The CIA didn't put up its hand and volunteer to do this any more than the CIA volunteered to assassinate Fidel Castro. Presidents command the CIA, but presidents won't always take the rap.
Weren't there any who objected to the CIA activity as maybe immoral? What about Jimmy Carter? I mean,
now Jimmy Carter is a different kettle of fish on this, and I have talked to him about this face to face. Carter campaigned in 1976 at the height of the furor over the Cold War activities of the CIA that had been exposed as a consequence of Watergate. And I'm talking about assassination plots, all authorized by presidents, by the way, Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy. I'm talking about secret prisons. I'm talking about the use of mind-altering drugs like LSD in a search for some kind of truth serum. And all of these had come to light. And President Carter, on the campaign trail, when he was governor of Georgia and running, condemned the CIA as a national disgrace. However, when he took office, he wanted to use the CIA, as all presidents do, but he wanted to use it in a particular fashion, which was to further his foreign policy, which was based on human rights. And on the Helsinki Accords of 1975, which between the Soviet Union and the United States promoted, quote, the free movement of people and ideas, unquote. He used the CIA to try and get under the skin of the Soviets with samizdat, that is forbidden writings, with cassette tapes, with fax machines for the free flow of information behind the Iron Curtain. That proved to be a rather potent technique.
What would be some constructive advice that you would offer for the next president with respect to the CIA?
Well, the next president, whoever he or she might be, is probably going to have to renounce the use of torture as an instrument of American foreign policy. That is a stain on the honor of the United States. And on a very practical level, it makes it harder to recruit people as foreign agents. Let me try and explain that. During the Cold War, when the United States stood unquestionably for freedom, justice, democracy in the eyes of people behind the Iron Curtain. It was relatively easier for people to volunteer to work in secret for the United States as recruited agents. Mm. It was never easy, but it was relatively easier than it is today. How hard do you think it is today for the United States, for the CIA, to recruit secret intelligence agents from the nations of Islam, from the Mediterranean to the Pacific, after Abu Ghraib, after the revelation of secret prisons? Mm. Our conduct of the war on terror, and in particular the use of, shall we say, aggressive interrogation techniques, is a blot on the honor of the United States, and it needs to be removed. Now, no one probably understands that better than John McCain, who was tortured for 5.5 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. McCain has waffled somewhat on this issue of late, but he was against torture until fairly recently. He's waffled a bit on it. So that's job one. The second is we as a nation have to rededicate ourselves to setting up a professional intelligence service in this country. We have to have good intelligence, or we are not going to be a superpower for very much longer. It is absolutely necessary to have a smart, sharp, professional intelligence service in this country. We need to know what's going on abroad, or we're going to get into wars for the wrong reasons.
Which has been happening based on a lot of CIA misinformation. We've been going to war for the wrong reasons.
Well, I think Iraq is an example of choosing to go to war based on bad intelligence. We cannot afford to let that happen again. And in order to create a professional American intelligence service in this country, we're going to have a stand-up new generation of professional American intelligence officers, and they are going to need to know how to speak Arabic,
Chinese,
and Hindi, and Urdu, and Pashto, the language of Eastern Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and Chinese, Mandarin. And all those tough languages that bring down your grade point average.
Yes. Okay? Hello. Mm-hmm.
And they are going to have to know the history and the culture of the countries where these languages are spoken.
Well, Tim, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
Thank you, Valerie.
Tim Weiner's latest book is Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or browse our suggested reading list for both adults and children. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Technical producer, Mike Johns. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. For information on how to be a funder for Between the Lines, please call 678-686-0390. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.